Chairman Park Commission. Like they're wanting the commission to elect the chair. Some cases.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government Consumer Protection to order and into opening up a possible hearing. And I think it's very possible we will be hearing House Bill 2213 first. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2213. Yes, why don't you give us a little primer of the bill?
House Bill 2213, it directs the members of the Commission for Women to elect a chairperson and a vice chairperson and to determine the duties of the officers. It declares an emergency effective on passage. And we have Sue Kastner.
Thank you. And we also have Representative Cobb. Would you like to come up and speak? And also Sue Kastner. Good morning and welcome to General Government and Consumer Protection. I think you've been here before.
I have.
And not this session, but previously. So if you'd state your name for the record and provide us a little bit of testimony about this bill.
I sure will, Chair. Good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betty Comp. I represent House District 22, that's Woodburn, Jervis, and up in parts of North Salem. I'm going to be very brief. You have my testimony in front of you. I have been serving on the Oregon Women's Commission since the interim, and I've gotten to know my good friend here, Sue Kastner, and the work that this commission does. The Oregon Commission for Women was legislatively established in 1983 to work for women's equality, and as a mother of four daughters, I totally support that and all those good things. The commission does this by advocating for women in the community, providing information on women to the governor and the state legislature, linking, serving as a link for women to serve on our state agencies and provide services. The mission of the Oregon Commission for Women is to work for the implementation, establishment of economic, social, legal, and political equality for women, and maintain a continuing assessment of the needs, issues and needs that confront us as Oregonians. To this bill, currently the Oregon Women's Commission bylaws allow for members to elect a chairperson and vice chairperson by vote of the commission. HB 2213 will align Oregon statutes with the current Oregon Women's, what is that? What does it say, that OCFW? Thank you. I don't deal with acronyms. And as an educator, that's almost impossible.
And what was that acronym?
Oregon Council.
CFW, Oregon Commission for Women.
Yeah. Oregon Commission for Women. I'll say it three more times and I'll have it.
I got it.
Well, it's me, Paul. Additionally, House Bill 2213 will maintain consistency with the Commission on Hispanic Affairs, the Commission on Black Affairs, and the Commission on Asian Affairs. Said elections will result in elections of a chairperson and vice chairperson for one-year terms and will determine the duties of the officers. This is a high-functioning committee, and we want to parallel the behaviors and actions that our other commissions have, and with that, I support this bill and hope you do too.
For the record, I'm Sue Kastner. I'm the current chair of the Oregon Commission for Women, or the OCFW. First, I would be remiss if I did not thank Representative Betty Comp for her service on the Commission for Women. As chair of the commission, it has been both a pleasure and an honor to work with her. Representative Comp's dedication and commitment to the women of Oregon, as well as her guidance and leadership to the commissioners, serve as an inspiration and a motivation to all of us who have come to know and respect her. With that said, House Bill 2213 will simply bring state statute in line with the commission's existing bylaws. It will merely allow the members of the Oregon Commission for Women to elect their chair as opposed to having the governor appoint their chair. And I believe at this point, in this session of all sessions, I think he's going to be hopefully concentrating on a few more things than choosing a chair for the Women's Commission. While we all serve at the pleasure of the governor, it only makes sense to allow the working members of the commission to vote for their own chair as the members of the other three advocacy commissions currently do. This is by no means a popularity contest on the commission. We take it very seriously. It is an honest evaluation by the commissioners serving side by side to choose the individual they see as the person who will get things done and will lead them through these challenging times. So with that, I thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank
you. One more comment. As I see the collection of membership on this committee,
we could use some help from your commission.
We didn't have you do with that.
Well, we just need to continue finding strong women leaders, and that is part of what we do in our work.
Yeah, I did complain about that and asked for Representative Buckley to give a few women out of Ways and Means.
Yeah, the rest of us are in Ways and Means.
So, I appreciate it. Any questions on the bill from the committee? I think this is pretty straightforward. Looks like a good measure, and I really appreciate your testimony bringing it forward. I hope it succeeds in making the commission more efficient and working better together.
Mr. Chair, your question.
Representative Clem.
Sue, my wife has been on the Commission on Asian Affairs for way past what's reasonable to ask any person to volunteer that much time. Have you considered that, like her, you may continue to be reelected by your commission? I think she was chair six times in a row, and they wouldn't let her go. Have you thought about that personally?
Truth be told here, I'm actually moving to California, so I will not be serving any longer.
Your commissioners may not let you.
It is a challenge, but part of what I think it's incumbent upon the commissioners to go out and recruit new people and get new ideas. We were defunded, a while ago and basically reconstituted the Women's Commission to the point where we have a bunch of people who want to do things. And I think that Carol is a workhorse, though. She does it, and she's great. Yeah, don't roll your eyes.
But I think she is.
The commissioners have to go out and recruit other people to take the leadership roles.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair. I was a commissioner and a commission chair myself, and we elected it from within the body, and I feel that's the best method personally, because you get the trust, but you get camaraderie from your fellow commissioners, and you have to work to keep their vote if you want to stay chair. And I mean, I think it's significantly superior. I've advocated for it here in these committees. The speaker's ignored me, but I did ask for that multiple times.
Well, maybe he listened to you on this one.
Yeah.
So, I appreciate that and your testimony. Thank you very much.
With that,
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2213 and open a work session on House Bill 2213.
Chair Hovey, I move we pass House Bill 2213. The floor would do pass recommendation.
Representative Wim Wisnett moves House Bill 2213 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? It's been my practice to have a roll call vote on passing measures. So could we have that, please?
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Quinn.
Is that me?
I thought you said Broom. Sorry.
Aye.
But he's not here.
Representative Palmer.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Vice Chair Sheehan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair
Wilson. Aye. House Bill 2213, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And could we have Representative Comp carry that on the floor? Very good. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2213. In the audience, we have two representatives here to testify on a couple other bills. You guys can flip a coin, see which one wants to go first.
Mr. Chair, I'm in committee this morning. Would prefer to come here and get back to my other meeting.
Very good. With that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2320. Yeah, why don't you give us a little explanation of the bill, Jan?
House Bill 2320 requires state agencies making documents available in electronic form to make those documents available in formats used by programs running on the two most commonly used proprietary operating systems, and the most commonly used non-proprietary operating system.
Good morning, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. I brought this bill and the companion bill because I was, in this particular case, I was concerned about the fact that the state government did not appear to me at the time I was drafting this bill to have a coherent plan for how documents were to be prepared and the format they were to be stored in for the purpose of making them available to the public. If you're in a business agency, a business concern, and your main object with documents is to keep them proprietary and private, you can pick any format you want. Require other people in the enterprise to use the same formatting system and the same software, and it's really simple. For us, it's much more complex for a whole lot of reasons, and that really was the point of this bill, was to make certain that documents, when they are made available to the public, are made available in formats that the public can manage. Since the bill was drafted, it has become clear that there are a number of considerations that are not in the bill that need to be considered. I've had conversations with the Department of Administrative Services about what they're already doing and about their plans. I would strongly suggest the committee hear them on that issue. The point I was trying to get at was the point that public documents should be readable by the public, whether you're running an old Apple II or whether you're running the most modern Linux-based system. You ought to be able to read the documents that are available at Oregon.gov on your computer with the software that you normally use for your other work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And if you would like to sit there all concurrently, open a public hearing on House Bill 2321. Good morning. If you'd like to identify yourself for the record again for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart, State Representative from House District 11. House Bill 2321 is relating to electronic mail. The purpose of this bill, the concept behind this bill, was to make it possible for state agencies, local governments, and others to give public notices by email rather than by the other means that were available, that are required in various statutes throughout the Oregon Revised Statutes. Most public notices, of course, are given by local governments for local concerns. I personally receive notices in the mail on a regular basis from the city of Eugene about road construction, sewers, from Eugene Water Electric Board, about water, about land use, zoning, and a whole variety of other kinds of things. Every now and then I'll get one from some state agency, and of course we all receive mail from state agencies. So the object of this bill, as I conceived it, was essentially to make it possible for them to stop sending postcards or spending money on printing and mailing of notices when the people who they're sending the notice to have agreed to receive the notice by electronic mail instead. And that would apply in a blanket way. So wherever it says in the statute, inform this group of people by first-class mail, certified mail, some other form, if the person has filed with the agency a request that those notices be sent to a particular email address instead, that would be allowable. Now, again, Department of Administrative Services has some concerns about the bill as drafted. I am not wedded to the language in this bill, nor was I in the language in House Bill 2320. But I'm very pleased to see that the committee is looking at this concept, and hopefully whatever you end up with will work and will accomplish the goal that these two bills have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Barnhart? Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative. And I want to say really appreciate the your commitment to trying to find ways for us to save money and give people good access to information. And if you covered this a little bit or if I just missed it, I apologize. In the requirement of the electronic mail, have we considered sort of spam filters and making sure that people actually see it? I mean, I get some, you know, almost all the email that I get sent, I see, right? But there's some portion of it, some not insignificant portion that I don't. Have we, you know, pretty easy for the state to have a workaround to make sure pretty confident, or we just double up with doing the mail also? What do we know about that? Maybe it's not that big a deal.
I think that's a great question to ask Mr. Petty.
All right.
When he comes up, because that's a question he raised with me, and he had suggestions around
great
how to manage it. Representative,
thank you. Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, your testimony, I believe you said that there's that this system would require someone to opt in or to say that they wanted to receive the electronic mail, but in the bill it actually says the opposite, that if the public body has an electronic email address for the person and the person has not made a request for the mailing of paper copy of the notice. Can you clarify your intent there?
Well, I didn't intend to have it drafted the way it is drafted now, Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan. You're right. That's what it says. The studies that have been done on this issue, and I can give you a rough estimate. If you have an opt-in requirement, which is what I was mentioning earlier, you get 5 or 6%, maybe 2 or 3% people who will actually opt in. If you have an opt-out requirement, you'll get more like 98%, because most people simply don't do anything. I suspect that my recollection of the bill changed partly because of my conversation with the Department of Administrative Services and their concern about the management of an opt-out process. But you're right, that is what it says.
Thank you. Representative Klum.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2320, and just, you know, I heard your examples of the operating system. You obviously didn't say the words Microsoft. So when you're talking about electronic forms, electronic documents, you know, I think of like PDF, for example. And but the bill is obviously about operating systems. And so does Linux not, is Adobe PDF not work with Linux? Or is that what you're trying to get at, that there are, or Word documents don't work in Linux because they don't, I mean, I don't use Linux, so I don't know. Nor do most of the people in the country, obviously. And so what exactly are you worried about, people not being able to use Linux and read state government documents?
Chair Holby, Representative Klum. No, and I think that's a drawback with the way the bill actually got drafted. When you're, the most common formats are available on every operating system that is still being supported, whether it's a proprietary system or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you use OpenOffice, for example, that document reading and preparing program works on all of the more common operating systems, and there are versions of that program now that can read the XML formats that Microsoft has recently published. The formatting ones that now end in X, like .docx, that read the open document format, which for several years has been an attempt by the open source community to develop a common document formatting system that is open and not proprietary, so anyone can use it. They can certainly read PDF files and write them. So there are lots of options for those kinds of it isn't really the operating system that counts. It's really the program that reads the document. Currently, for example, the version of Word that I have on my computer at home is an older version of Word. It does not natively read HTML formatted documents. When I open a document from the legislature, which ends in an X, it has to go through a conversion program, and the warning always comes up that it may have lost some language or some formatting because of the translation. I believe that the state should not be using HTML formatted documents unless or until it is clear. I mean, for when they go out to the public, unless it is clear that the document reading programs that people regularly use have caught up with that format. Especially since so many other formats are regularly available for us to use.
Yes, and I'm wondering whether it might be appropriate to bring the agency up. They might be able to give us probably a little more detail, Rep. Sam Clem, unless you...
I'm trying to get at what's in his head, not the agency's.
Right. Then that's going to be a tough job, but go ahead.
You thought of the bill, obviously. So I think I'm getting you. So, like, if most people are using Word 2003, Word 2007, which is not DocX, it's just Doc still, until this survey says most people are now at, or maybe 2007 is, I don't know, but until most people are in DocX, you don't want to see the state moving to DocX. You want to see them staying with where most of the public is, like just Doc. That's what I do for a living, and I have to get all my customers to go get that converter, and it's annoying. I mean, it really is annoying. But as soon as they start getting an email from somebody, they call their IT guy, and then I've got to figure out what the problem is, and it won't open, and then I figure it out. But I think that's what you were thinking.
That is exactly the issue that I'm trying to raise. I wouldn't be too wedded to the language in the bill as it exists, because I think the bill as it exists probably does not accomplish the results that I'm interested in.
Yeah. Thank you. That helps. I think I understand.
No other questions, Representative Barnhart. Thank you very much for giving us the primer on these two bills, and we're going to hear from the agency, and we'll talk some more about them later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So I still have the public hearing on both 2320 and 2321 open, and so we'll bring up Sean McSpaden. I hope I said that right. And Dugan Petty. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee. And if you'd state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Hobley and Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is Dugan Petty. I'm the state's Chief Information Officer, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2321. And with us is Sean McSpaden.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, for the record, my name is Sean McSpaden. I serve as Oregon's Deputy State Chief Information Officer, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2320.
Thank you. Why don't you go right ahead?
Certainly. Co-Chairs, Co-Vice Chair Sheehan and Smith, and members of the committee, the purpose of my testimony this morning is to provide information to the committee and to raise specific questions that DAS has related to House Bill 2320 as introduced. For the most part, I'll try to summarize the more detailed written testimony I've submitted to the committee this morning. I'll just briefly restate what House Bill 2320 says as introduced. Section 1 essentially requires the Department of Administrative Services to determine the most common proprietary and non-proprietary operating systems used on desktop and laptop computers sold in the United States at least once every 2 years. It then requires, in Section 2, that state agencies make documents available in document formats used by those proprietary and non-proprietary operating systems. Mm-hmm. To assess the relative ease or difficulty in fulfilling the obligations outlined in Section 1, we contacted Gardner Incorporated, the world's leading IT research and advisory services firm. Gardner was able to provide us with actual and forecasted information on the PC installed base and the relative percentage of operating systems used by desktops and laptops sold in the United States from 2007 to 2014. For 2009, the most recent year that Gardner had actuals, approximately 92% of the PC installed base for the U.S. market utilized Microsoft Windows, 5% utilized Apple Macintosh-based operating systems, and just a bit over 2% utilized Linux-based operating systems, and all the different brands of the Linux operating system were lumped together in that particular study. In terms of forecasts, between 2010 and 2014, Gardner forecasts the use of Microsoft Windows will decrease slightly to about 88%, while Apple Macintosh use will raise to about 9%. Linux-based operating systems are forecasted to remain just under 3%. And so we're looking at 97% proprietary and 3% or less non-proprietary operating systems. In addition, Representative Flynn, we had some of the same questions for Representative Barnhart about the intent of the bill. We thought that it moved beyond operating systems and moved more closely to office productivity software and perhaps even open data file formats, really as the primary focus of the bill. With that said, we did conduct some research in regard to office productivity software tools. Based on that research, OpenOffice and variations like StarOffice and Google Docs are the primary alternatives in the marketplace today to Microsoft Office, although Office is by far the most predominantly deployed Office productivity suite in the marketplace. Microsoft Office runs on Windows and Apple Macintosh operating systems. Google Docs is a browser-based system that runs on web browsers on Windows, Mac, and Linux-based operating systems. So it's essentially ubiquitous. The operating system does not matter generally. Google recently rolled out a product called Cloud Connect that connects Office and Google Docs directly. It allows users to operate the Office interface while using Google Doc features. OpenOffice is now, as Representative Barnhart indicated, is able to read and write Microsoft Office files. This allows users to open and save Word, Excel, and PowerPoint files on their preferred platform, including Windows, Macintosh operating systems, Linux, and an operating system called Solaris. Finally, in regard to the file formats that agencies typically post documents or exchange documents, they typically make them available in either Microsoft Office file formats or Adobe PDF file formats or both. And generally on Oregon.gov, agencies post both file types for the very reasons that Representative Barnhart was talking about. So with that said, the research we've conducted to date appears to suggest that most Office productivity software programs that run on the most common proprietary and non-proprietary operating systems can read and write electronic documents in the same file formats that agencies use today. In terms of newer versus older file formats, to help address the potential issues or problems that those newer file formats may cause, free document converters can easily be found by the internet. Representative Clem, you're correct. It is a bit of an irritant, but once the converter is installed, all future documents in that newer file format can be read. In terms of electronic documents posted on Oregon.gov, the Department of Administrative Services has for many years provided a web style guide to agencies and a web link to a file format web page to the public, which is located on the footer of every web page posted on Oregon.gov. This file format web page provides information on downloading the required plugin or software to access alternative formats, free document viewers for Adobe Acrobat, Microsoft Word, Excel, and PowerPoint files are available to the public so they can view files that are posted on Oregon.gov. In terms of existing statutory authority, Oregon Revised Statute 291038 directs the Department of Administrative Services to adopt statewide information technology-related policies, rules, and standards. These rules, policies, and standards are to be formulated to promote electronic communication and information sharing across state agencies and programs, between state and local governments, and with the public where appropriate. In our view, should standards be necessary, DAS believes it already has the authority to set operating system, office productivity tool, and open data file format standards under that statute for executive branch agencies subject to DAS authority. We did have some questions for Representative Barnhart in a variety of areas, one of which has to do with formal definitions. Through conversations with a bill sponsor, we now understand that the intent of House Bill 2320 is for state agencies to make documents available in formats that are readily accessible or readable by the recipient of an electronic document. However, as currently written, the intent of House Bill 2320 is not clear. Formal definitions related to the affected state agencies, and what I mean by that is that currently there is not a statutory reference to what is meant by a state agency, whether the bill is intended to apply only to the executive branch or whether it's intended to apply to all three branches of state government. Also, formal definitions related to proprietary and non-proprietary operating systems, open data file formats, and electronic documents would be helpful for state agencies to determine the true focus and potential fiscal impact of a bill. Another area has to do with what is meant by making documents available and also the time frame that the bill is interested in. And so what I mean by that is that, as written, it is not clear whether the bill's focus is on electronic documents made available only via web posting or whether it intends to apply to documents to be made available via all possible means, including web posting and the exchange of files via email, file transfer protocol, external hard drives, CDs and DVDs, or flash drives, or other portable media. Further, it's not clear whether the bill's focus is on electronic documents made available only to the public, only in the future, or whether the bill's reach would include electronic documents made available currently and in the future to all parties, internal and external to state government. Those two points could dramatically affect whether the bill has a significant fiscal impact or not. With that, we believe additional clarity on these points would be helpful to agencies in determining the potential impacts of the bill. We do welcome the opportunity to work with the bill sponsor to identify potential bill amendments or to pursue other administrative actions that could be performed within existing DAS statutory authority that might better address the underlying intent of the bill. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for that. It was very thorough. Just a quick little question. I mean, we're pretty aware that the bill apparently has some problems with clarity and things like that, for sure. But does DAS look at this bill as something that could be beneficial? Are you willing to continue to look at this concept as Representative Barnhart's kind of laid out his intent and determine whether or not this bill is actually going to provide a value to a state government at a little cost?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, the commitment we've made to Representative Barnhart is to work with him to any extent he needs us to improve the bill should it move forward. We're neutral on the bill. We believe that the Department of Administrative Services and state agencies have taken appropriate actions. Clearly, we can always do better. We can always, in particular, in terms of exchange of information with the public, it may be prudent for us to review what we're doing today and determine whether it's sufficient. The marketplace and the data that we've gathered on the marketplace seems to indicate that most computers that are shipped today and that will be shipped in the next 4 to 5 years run on operating systems and typically come with office productivity software that can read files that state agencies use today. So,
thank you. Any other questions? Representative Sheehan.
Mr. McSpadden, so to summarize, you're already doing this. This is something that, is there a reason why you would need a statute to come in and tell you to do this? It sounds like this is already being managed under your own agency's best practices. Would that be correct?
Co-chairs, Representative Sheehan, as I indicated in my testimony, we believe the Department of Administrative Services already has the statutory authority that it needs.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the first of all, I want to say I really appreciate the work you guys have been doing and Doug and the work you've been doing to try to, you know, move state government processes into the 21st century. I know it's a challenging, you know, multi-million dollar, occasionally mistakes, but also successes process. I want to appreciate that. And I can't pander to Phil because he's not in the room, but also want to, you know, so I personally appreciate the intent of the bill. I mean, I know that we've both been in a situation where state government might or not already have the statutory authority to do something and might not have additional purpose to have a management tool for you guys to be able to say to folks, hey, this isn't just because, you know, I'm being a jerk to you guys, you staffers, and asking you to do more. I'm saying doing this because the legislature is asking us to do it. So I hope that we will at least be rigorous in our exploration if there's something worth doing. And I guess that's what I'd say about that.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. McSpadden? Mr. Petty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On House Bill 2320...
State your name for the record again,
my
please.
Chair... thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dugan Petty. I'm the state's chief information officer with the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you.
House Bill 2321 is the bill requiring electronic notice. If there's a notice required by statute and an agency has an email address, then it must, under this bill, notify people in an electronic format unless people have asked not to be notified in that way. This bill on the surface makes tremendous sense, and that's why a lot of agencies are moving to electronic notification where possible, primarily because when you look at the paper-based mail notification up against the electronic notification system, there are tremendous savings out over time. And so right on the surface of it, that makes good sense. Another reason it makes good sense, I think, here in Oregon is that Oregonians are online and online savvy. In a recent 2010 State New Economy Index was published in November by the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Oregon ranked 8th in the nation in what they call a digital economy indicator. And that's based on some interesting statistics, I think. It's based on the percentage of population online. It's based on the use of information technology to deliver state services and state government. It's based on the percentage of farmers online using computers. It's based on the deployment of broadband telecommunications. And it's based on health IT. And in a couple of those areas, Oregon scored really good. We were 4th in the nation on online use, on an online population indicator, with 84% of our population being online. Now, that's pretty significant. Also, we were 5th in the nation in our utilization of digital technologies in state government. So that tells you there's an opportunity to save money with electronic notice. That tells you we don't have that digital divide where people aren't ready to begin to receive these with electronic notice. So it seems to me that on the surface, this bill makes perfectly good sense, and we really need to figure out how to begin to take advantage of this if we're not already. third reason I think it makes sense is that public agencies are already providing a lot of notification online. We have an Oregon Procurement Information Network system that has an online bulletin board. It pushes out notices online to vendors. The Department of Administrative Services recently put up an online recruiting tool that has a lot of online capabilities, so we move away from the paper-based system unless somebody wants to know that. So it's really something whose time has come, and frankly, it's beginning to happen. I think Representative Barnhart wants to enable that and move that forward and take advantage of it, and that certainly makes perfectly good sense to me. But the bill has written has some concerns, and I want to talk a little bit about those concerns. First off, it's a mandatory requirement, and so we think there are likely to be circumstances where it's not practical, it's not cost-effective, or just not appropriate to send an electronic notice. And I don't know what all those are, but here's the problem with the bill where there's a mandatory requirement. At some point, to make that work, we're going to have a bunch of exceptions defined, and it's really hard to define all of those exceptions. And so we know that there are some out there, and there are likely to be some rubbing points with this, so that's one concern. Statutory security requirements, does it make sense in some cases to send certain notices electronically? There may be a really good reason not to send it electronically, and the bill doesn't really allow for that. There can be a circumstance where the consequences of a non-receipt of an electronic notice are just too darn high to trust it. I mean, one of the benefits for certified return receipt requested is at least you know that somebody picked it up and signed for it. You don't have, even though the email systems allow for return receipt requested, you don't have the same rigor and strength to know that, in fact, somebody actually read the document or just clicked on the box. So you don't have that same strength to it. And there are times when, I mean, it's one thing if it's a meeting notice or some other a zoning change or some of the examples that Representative Barnhart listed. If that gets missed, it's not a big deal, perhaps. But in some cases, the notification is very serious. If your license is being revocated, if it's being revoked, that's pretty important to know about. And the consequences of missing that somehow are probably not only acceptable, not unacceptable to the citizen of Oregon, but there's also probably unacceptable to the agency. And then another unintended consequence of this bill is why, on the surface, electronic notification wins hand down in cost savings against formal written mail notification. But there are some initial costs with systems to make them email susceptible. There are some costs around this that will cause some agencies to have a first-time cost that may exceed the savings. And in this budget environment, that may not be the consequence we're really trying to get to here. A couple of other issues with this before I close out. Email is different than a permanent address. And because for the most part, when we move into an apartment or a house, we're there a little longer. Email, we may have 5-6 different email systems, and they may change quite a bit. It may be a new system. And when we put that down in the first-time application, how do we make sure that the email system or the email address continues to get updated? So the transitory nature of the email address is different than a permanent physical address. And then finally, one of the things that I've heard in the last week as we prepared for testimony in this bill was concern on public agencies' parts about whether or not this bill would hold them harmless against an action brought by somebody who did not receive a notification. And so does the agency get set up for some kind of a legal action, and then would they have some potential damages or liabilities with response to that action? So we think on whole, this bill is going in the right direction. It's the kind of thing we ought to be doing to reduce the cost of government and to make sure that we're getting the notifications of the public in the way they want to receive it. But there are a lot of potential unintended consequences that could be teased out with this. And we think it makes sense to sit down with a sponsor, maybe have a work group, and see if we can't bring the concerns that other agencies would have, other public agencies would have with this, to see if we can craft some amendments that can make this bill begin to do what the sponsor hopes it could do, reduce cost, make notice available to people in the way they want to receive it, but yet not have some of the consequences to it that are difficult to deal with. Finally, one other thing I ought to mention with this, in the discussion with Representative Barnhart about really both of these bills in tandem, is this notion that, you know, the first way to transmit information, and maybe the best way to transmit it, is to post it on an effective website, give people notice, but let them access those documents there. That way we're not sending huge documents and really duplicating a lot of different storage costs, because when we send those documents around in state government, we store them in our system, and then when you get them, you're storing that data in your system, drives costs up. We store them one place on a site, let people know where it is with a link, let them access it. Then the access to that document is easy. It solves some of the problem that's trying to be dealt with in House Bill 2320. You go on site, you access the information, and you get it. So that's something that could be looked at within this bill in a work group as well, potentially. So those are my comments. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Let's see. Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Petty, first of all, this strikes me, the intent of this seems to be something that you should already be doing, and agencies should already be doing, is an easy opportunity to save money, because I think everybody, or most people, understand that electronic mail is cheaper than paper plus postage. So it sounds like probably we are already attempting to do this, but I also share your concern about the unintended consequences of broadly mandating something that frankly may conflict with other rules and requirements. And it occurred to me, I don't know if, I'm assuming that this, as written, the bill would apply, for example, to the Department of Justice. I wonder how service of process would fit into, you know, complying with court rules that have a certain method of being able to serve process in a lawsuit that generally does not include email. So anyway, share your concerns, and I kind of wonder your opinion whether, again, a legislative mandate is necessary, or whether we should look to you and say, do you need additional statutory authority to do something like this, or other programs, like you were saying, to save money?
Co-chairs, Representative Conger, I think we have the authority in statute to do this, but part of it is whether or not it's a good business decision on the part of the agency. We want to encourage electronic notifications where it makes sense, and there are a lot of systems, particularly the new ones that are getting built, that would have that feature built into the development of it. But there are some difficulties with existing systems out there, because if they have to be modified to go out and create the forms and the modifications to begin to send the notice out, it may have a one-time cost that couldn't be amortized inside of a budget cycle. New systems, it makes sense because you're designing them from the ground up, and the cost benefit of doing the electronic notification, if it's feasible for the business need, makes good sense. So there are a lot of examples of state agencies that have systems that do this already and are moving in that direction. I think you make a good point that there are probably some kinds of notice that frankly will maybe never make sense to do electronically, at least in the near future. I mean, it could be a decade from now, but it will be completely different. This world is moving pretty quickly, and it's a lot different today than it was 10 years ago. So I hesitate to say that never, but I think those decisions have to be made really by the business owner about whether or not it truly makes sense and there's a cost benefit. And this bill doesn't really allow that balance.
Thank you.
Question? Chair Holby?
Yes. Please speak your name for the record, please.
Certainly. Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean McSpaden. I serve as Oregon's Deputy State Chief Information Officer. Just wanted to segue with Mr. Petty's comments address a couple of portions of Representative Conger's question. You asked whether the Department of Administrative Services has the authority that it needs. An important distinction of House Bill 2321 is that it applies to all public bodies, That extends beyond state agencies under our department's authority. And so as we talked with Representative Barnhart, it is possible that this particular bill as written could have unintended fiscal impacts on local governments. That's an issue that needs to be addressed. Also, as we talked with Representative Barnhart, we discussed the possibility of changing the mandatory requirement to a more permissive or discretionary requirement, and then we address many of the concerns that we have.
Question? Representative Smith.
So I understand the testimony, it's helpful. If it's high benefit, right, or it resolves high costs, then maybe it makes sense to have, you know, sort of a default rule of a requirement with a bunch of exceptions, like, you know, exceptions where it's a family email and somebody else might read it, exceptions where it's a Department of Justice document that, you know, really only one person should see unless they really want their lawyer to see it. If it saves us a lesser amount of money, that it makes more sense to have the default, you know, so we get 98% and then carve from there. If it saves us less money, it makes more sense to start with 2% and then hopefully someday sort of the tectonic shift in this direction so we get there. Do we have even a cocktail napkin estimate of how much money we're spending right now on paper mailed notices?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, we don't at this time, and we looked at putting a fiscal impact together on this in a pretty short period of time that we had a chance to look at the bill, and we just don't have that background data available. We may be able to get some sense from our printing and distribution, at least for state agencies, how much, what's the flow of outgoing mail is through them, but that's not necessarily all.
It's not all notices.
And right. So it's hard to get that split, and there's no real easy way to come to understand that. We've kind of scratched our head about that.
Right, well, I would just say follow up. Sure. Yeah, if there is a way to work with the sponsor and do something that makes sense, I mean, it would be great. If we can gather, even just a rough estimate of what we think that is, both within the DAS ambit as well as within sort of a broader ambit, which is a harder number to get, but again, even just within a standard deviation, you know, sort of sense, or 4 cents, you know, that'd be really valuable.
Mr. Co-chairs, we will check with our printing and distribution and see if we can get some sense of what it is, at least for state government, and maybe we could make some.
Yeah, because I don't know if it's tens of millions, hundreds of thousands, or 1 million. Like, I just no basis.
Thank you. I think that was a good point that, you know, we're always looking for ways to save money, and maybe there's some capacity to save some revenue in this direction. Whether or not these bills get us there or not remains to be seen without some changes, obviously. And certainly I am cognizant of the potential impacts to local governments, but I'm assuming they didn't sign up to testify, so they're either neutral or waiting to see this flush out before they weigh in on it. But I would imagine they would have an interest in this, though it hasn't been expressed yet. Any other comments, questions? Rips and Wisnet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Petty and Mr. McSpadden, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your work. I want to put on the record, I've complimented Mrs. Taylor. I want also, on behalf of Representative Smith and myself, compliment Mr. Petty and your work and leadership on the transparency bill that was passed last session. That's good for the people of Oregon. I think Representative Barnhart had good intentions with these two bills. I think there's unforeseen consequences, workload, and cost with these two bills. Both my colleagues, Representative Conger and Representative Shee, brought up, I think it is within your mission, and the work I've seen by Mr. Petty and Mrs. Taylor, I'm sure you guys can handle this and make it better. I would disagree with you that I think your numbers about email access are skewed by the Portland numbers. If you go to Curry and Josephine County, you may not find very high numbers having email access. Also, I hope you'll continue to work this issue and also be sure you're interfacing with the employment agency to be sure that people that need jobs are getting that information. Veterans that are looking for jobs are getting that information, because that's what we're here to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. With that, I appreciate you coming in and going over this for us. It is an important issue, and I hope to have few other conversations with Representative Barnhart and yourselves to see if there is some pathway to accomplishing the goal. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2320 and close the public hearing on House Bill 2321 and going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2854. Jan, would you give us a little summary of the next bill, please?
House Bill 2854 requires the Department of Administrative Services to establish policies, methods, and means by which it and other public agencies it has agreements with will manage motor pool resources cost-effectively and efficiently. It requires DAS to report on the costs, the benefits, and effectiveness of its actions each biennium to the Legislative Assembly.
Thank you. And signed up for testimony, Representative Nathanson. Good morning, and I apologize. I suppose I could have opened this public hearing and got you in and out of here a little quicker, and I appreciate your patience to testify on this bill. So with that, welcome, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13, and the previous discussions were very interesting to me. I've been working on information technology projects as well. I was glad to hear them. This bill is one of several bills that the House will be hearing this session that come from the Government Efficiency Task Force. As you may recall, that group looked at a number of program areas or services where the state and local governments share and have overlapping responsibilities. Recognizing the need to restructure the delivery of government services, becoming more efficient and finding process improvements is always a great idea. But this is about restructuring the delivery of government services. Representatives of state and local governments came together on that task force and worked together to identify process improvements, fix problems, eliminate burdensome requirements, and so on. And again, rather than focusing only on the state, what can we do within our four figurative walls? What should we do in collaboration with local governments? Because it's all taxpayer money, and local governments are in just as much hurt as the state government is. So the task force approved nearly two dozen ideas to include in its report of final recommendations to this legislative assembly. Some of those recommendations will be accomplished through administrative actions, but others are making their way through the bill hearing process because they require some statutory change to make things better. This bill is one of those ideas. We need to work together better and work smarter, and we need to do it in conjunction with our county partners. So as chair of the task force, I'm very happy to let you know that the task force unanimously supported forwarding this idea and several others that you will be hearing. For this bill, you will hear that there are already some places where we, the state, have collaborated with local government. And that's great. I'm pleased. But the effort shouldn't stop there. We shouldn't rest on our laurels, as the saying goes. This bill says simply that we will continue to proactively mine for opportunities. It's not okay anymore to just be stuck in neutral and satisfied with the status quo. In the reports for our task force, you'll find that the subcommittee that developed this idea said, quote, state, county, and city motor pool services become more efficient through enhancement of existing partnerships and consolidation of space, purchasing, repairs, etc., end quote. There is not a single collective data set that tells us what public agency motor pools exist in Oregon. We simply don't know how many of them there are and how many vehicles are being managed by public agencies. State and local government, special districts, public utilities, and the like. We don't know how many of these there are or how they're managed. So it's difficult for the state and our local government partners to realize the full potential for collaboration if we simply don't know what exists, much less reach out to start doing something about it. I'll give you one example just in my county alone. In Lane County, only in the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan area, there are multiple individual motor pools operated by local public bodies. Eugene Water and Electric Board, Lane County, City of Eugene, City of Springfield, Lane Transit District, and also the University of Oregon. But that is formerly the state motor pool. And it appeared maybe we were saving money for the state, but I maintain it was just a cost shift, because instead of the state maintaining the motor pool, someone else is maintaining it. And rather than a discussion between the state and local partners of how to deploy vehicles and how to operate and manage and schedule and repair them more efficiently, everybody's still doing their same old thing. This bill does not mandate any particular one-size-fits-all solution for any particular area. It doesn't say that we're going to close any specific motor pool or sell off any specific fleet. It asks the department to start reaching out more proactively to local government to look for efficiencies. A group of very clever people may find in some geographic area that maybe we have 20% more vehicles than we need, if you count all of them. Maybe some can be sold or mothballed, or maybe they can just be deployed better. It may be that there are always shortages in this motor pool, but excess over here, and it's a matter of better deployment. The bill instructs DAS to report to the legislature on potential costs and benefits of combining motor pool activities. Not necessarily only physical sites, but activities such as repair and maintenance of equipment. The required report will ensure attention to continuous improvement. In the previous discussions, and in others I've heard on bills, there's often a question, if the department already has the authority to do this, why do we need a statute? I want to attempt to answer that question. The department does have the authority, and I want to congratulate the department for reaching out and doing a couple of these kinds of things. The issue is more of we haven't acted fast enough, and we don't have a proactive program of reaching out with local government and convening those sorts of discussions in a geographic area. I think the state can take the lead in helping our local governments find those efficiencies, and I do think it's important for us not only to allow the authority, but to provide the direction saying it's time to do this, you need to work on this. We're very serious about looking for efficiencies. This bill gives the direction to do it. I'm very pleased that on the task force, we unanimously recommended that you consider this idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. I appreciate this. This looks like a smart direction to take. Are you aware of any, have you gotten any input from local governments or anybody else on any kind of problems they may have with the bill?
No, I have not, Mr. Chair. And I have talked with third hand, I have heard from a Lane County representative, a government liaison, that they haven't had an opportunity to look at the bill, but they're interested in the ideas. But I have heard no opposition from either counties or cities.
So in the Government Efficiency Task Force, the local government was a part of that.
That's correct. We had as many members representing local government as state government. There were county commissioners, a mayor, someone from the Special Districts Association. So there, it was intentionally designed as an equal blend of state and local government partners talking about these ideas.
Great. Appreciate that for the record. Not seeing any questions. Oh, wait a second. There is one down there. Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nathanson, thank you for your testimony and for your work on this. It does make a lot of sense, and I just have really two questions. One is sort of implicit in what you said is an acknowledgement that we don't even know how many vehicles we have. I'm not sure. You may have said that explicitly. Can you suggest a reason why we wouldn't know how many vehicles the state owns?
Mr. Chair and Representative Conger, the state knows. What we don't have is a survey or a calculation of all those other local government or public agency motor pools to figure out the total size of the challenge. I won't call it a problem yet, challenge.
You don't happen to have that number with you, do you?
I don't.
The number
I'm
of
sorry.
State-owned vehicles. So I was just curious then, second question is, did the task force look at doing away completely with the state motor pool? And to the extent that we need to use vehicles for state business, and we can't just reimburse people for using their vehicles, did you look at maybe a leasing program or something like that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Conger, no, the task force did not look at that particular solution. I am aware that some information exists from a couple of years ago. The Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government heard a report from the Department of Administrative Services, ideas about what alternatives are there to owning vehicles and, contracting or reimbursing and so forth. So there is some information and at least a memorandum that exists that describes what it would be like to consider alternatives.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Any other Representative Sheehan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nathanson, is the idea behind this to remove some sort of redundancy among the smaller motor pools and maybe consolidate? Is that where the cost savings are coming in? I'm just trying to understand the intent of this.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Sheehan. Yes, that is one of the hoped-for potential outcomes. It may be that in a geographic area you have three or four motor pools and you find you can make do with only two if they're located in the right places. It may be instead of having too many sites, maybe it's too many vehicles and you have more than you need here and not enough there, and if you redeploy you end up with a total number of fewer. But again, it's hard to say, because from one area to another the solution is probably different. It probably depends on distance and access to certain agencies, because we're talking not only about state uses but other local government entity or utility districts or special district uses.
I have one more question for you. The part about directing DAS to do this and do it in a cost-effective and efficient manner, the cost-effective and efficient part of it, where's the review of that, and who determines whether it's cost-effective and efficient? Would that be the Ways and Means process, I would assume?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. The department would be preparing a report for the legislature, and I believe that the Ways and Means process is another hook into that to reviewing the efficiency, yes. And I also would like to mention that I recognize very well that departments are going to be really strapped, especially when we need to do more with less. This report doesn't aim to solve the whole problem for the whole state and all 36 counties at one time. It asks the department to start with a pilot program, to pick at least one area to start with and see what they can do there. We're not trying to, this bill doesn't try to overreach and solve the whole problem all in one year, for example.
Great. I appreciate that clarification as well. So I don't see any other questions for you. Appreciate very much you working on this issue amongst others with the Government Efficiency Task Force and bringing them to this committee for its consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to bring up Brian King next, please. Good morning, and if you would state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, co-chairs, Holby and Wisnett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian King. I am the statewide fleet administrative manager for the Department of Administrative Services, also known as DAS Fleet by many. In relation to House Bill 2054, I'm here to provide information about DAS Fleet's activities with public agencies and estimated cost to expand these activities for light fleet vehicles. light fleet vehicles are what DAS fleet generally handles. Those are vehicles that are under 8,500 pounds of gross vehicle weight. DAS fleet purchases, repairs, fuels, and disposes of the vehicles for 31 local government and other non-state agency customers. We also have 15 non-active agreements with other local governments. DAS fleet is self-funded through service charges, and all revenues and expenditures to provide services pass through the DAS fleet budget. For this biennium, charges to these 31 customers total $884,564 through December. The projected amount for the full biennium is just over $1.3 million. House Bill 2854 directs DAS to establish policies and practices for how state and public agencies, including local governments, can use and share vehicles. For our current customers, DAS fleets assist by spreading the acquisition costs of vehicles across many or a few budget cycles for our local government customers. In this way, we act like a leasing agent, except we don't charge financing or interest charges. We also provide a one-stop shop for our services where our customers get one bill at the end of the month for the cost of their vehicles, their fuel, their maintenance, and any other vehicle-related charges. While we could provide more of our services to help local governments with budget issues, this will increase the expenditures that flow through our budget. We estimate that this amounts to approximately 3.2 million and up to 4.47 FTE for every 500 vehicles we add under our management. This estimate is to manage vehicles that already exist in public agencies, and we would take on under any consolidation type efforts. New additional vehicle requests would add an estimated $1 million to purchase for every 50 vehicles requested. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. King. Is the committee members questions? No questions? Mr. King, DAS, you would be working with DAS on this bill that we're looking at to come up with this. And now, this legislative body loves pilot projects. I don't understand how big a pilot project you think you were looking at. And I think we all support this idea and concept, but how's it going to really work, and we're going to get effective data, I guess, is the question this body would be asking.
Co-Chair Wisnet, members of the committee, are in many ways some of the relationships we have now are pilot programs. We do on the back of my testimony is a list of all the vehicles we provide to the local governments across Oregon right now. Okay, so some of those are public safety agencies, as mentioned in the bill. We could expand that to provide more to a specific area, as Representative Nathanson talked about. Multnomah County is having some issues right now. We could look into how we would be able to help them. So, and it really comes down to, as Representative Nathanson said, we have to determine where the biggest need is. Once the word gets out that we can move forward to do this, who's going to step forward to say, I need the help, is a big question in our mind.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, certainly.
So you're telling us that when we look at this study that the budget people are going to have to, if you pick up management another 500 vehicles, that your cost is going to go up 3.2 million and almost five FTEs. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Wisnet and members of the committee, that is correct. The FTE is an estimate because some of it depends on how we're going to do it, where it is.
Yep. Follow up, Mr. Chair. So what we have to look at is how much we've saved from those other departments, right? As a statewide, if you're picking that up, it could be a net, it could be a savings.
Co-Chair Wisnet, that's correct.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I don't understand why we only have 31 local governments, and would you identify or give me an example of some of the public agencies you're also purchasing and maintaining for?
Co-Chair Wisnet, members of the committee, some of the public agencies would be school districts, Willamette ESD, there's a couple school districts, as well as you have Umatilla, I believe it's a rescue. County Emergency Management in Umatilla, that's one of the public agencies. It's part of the county, but it's just one department within.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Certainly.
I understand the maintenance issue of not consolidating that, but I understand why they wouldn't be purchasing, why we wouldn't require all, you know, anyone we're providing services or money for that they wouldn't use you for the bulk buying. That doesn't make it. They're getting better deals than our local dealers. Is that, how does that work?
Co-chair, wasn't it, members of the committee? The cooperative purchasing agreements that many of the cities and counties are part of is a voluntary type of piece. If they are getting vehicles through us, we are doing the purchasing for those particular vehicles. Within, as you well know, many counties, the departments have quite a bit of autonomy, depending on the county, of how they're going to go about providing for their resources. And that's why you see some of the listed folks are parts of a county, a specific department that we're providing services for because they saw us as an advantage, but not necessarily the entire county.
Mr. Chair, one final comment.
Oh,
I think I'm going to go back and check on my county if they're not using a bulk purchase. The Department of Defense is probably one of the largest agencies or bureaucracies in the world, and everyone buys, you know, gets the same price because they buy such a large number. I can't understand why counties wouldn't want to participate in this. But thank you very much for your testimony. I hope the study is effective and provides us citizens of Oregon some savings because it's a big cost. I know from my experience on education, transportation, people don't understand how big a part of the education budget transportation is. We need to continue to look for ways to save money so we can put it in the classroom and put it for the needy citizens in Oregon. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. King, I just realized I should have asked you the question, or I think I should have, assuming you're in charge of all of the state-owned vehicles. And I think I'm talking specifically about the, what did you call it, the light fleet? Can you tell me or can you provide later the information how many vehicles we own? And I would also include with that, do you have or have you studied the utilization of the vehicles? You know, do we need all the vehicles that we own? Or do we have a plan to liquidate the ones that we aren't using? I know that's a series of questions, so if you don't know the answers now, I'd appreciate maybe a written response later.
Co-chairs and Representative Conger, I can provide some of those answers now. There are a few agencies that have independent authority, and I've just started to receive their biennial update on how many vehicles they have and their costs associated with them. For DAS Fleet, we have about 4,300 vehicles that fluctuate slightly depending on which ones are coming in new and which ones are going out the back door. As for the utilization, that has been one of my projects that I've been involved with, along with the previous DAS Director Scott Hara, to go to the agencies and start to seriously look at these vehicles that are, quote, underutilized, and what is the best way to manage them. One trap to stay out of is just because a vehicle doesn't go a certain number of miles a month doesn't necessarily mean it's not underutilized. If it has a specific purpose, it could be required that we have that. An example could be vehicles like DHS caseworkers who work in a populated area. That vehicle may not go very far, but it may serve quite a few clients in that area. So we are attacking that problem pretty strongly. I've had several agencies turn in vehicles over the last 2 months as ones they don't need, and they're being smart about it. They're picking the older ones that have maintenance problems and keeping the better ones that are a better deal for the state to continue to operate. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Wisnett.
You brought up a good point, Mr. King. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I work with some nonprofits in my county, and one day the director of this nonprofit said she was leasing a car for the day. And I know that in our campaign, our leader sometimes leased a car, rented a car for a day. It was cheaper than paying the miles. So you know, I hope that that's part of the study too, that renting and leasing for things. But I think I appreciate what you're saying as far as getting a car to go out, maybe not meet so many miles, but you've got distance and things to go out to visit the families, and that's important too. So, but I think also hopefully the study that I think this committee will support is that you look at sometimes leasing and to bring that fleet number down, or leasing. Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. King? I appreciate your efforts in this. I do have a question about the report in this bill that comes back to the legislature. I mean, when you look at that part of the bill, it's asking for a pretty thorough evaluation to report back to the legislature. Is that something that DAS has done before?
Co-chair Holby, members of the committee, we've generally done that mostly for ourselves and the other state agencies that have TLEAs. But I do think we can can do that. I think it'll be centered around what are their costs compared to what we're doing after. It's a real question here is, are we going to be less expensive, like Co-Chair Wisnett talked about? That's the real goal. And I think we can help in those areas. We have a lot of experience. DAS Fleet is recognized as one of the better-run state fleets in the nation. And we can certainly pass on that know-how to our local government partners.
So I'm guessing that DAS has pretty good access to the answers to those questions, but maybe hasn't just compiled it in one place and presented it to the legislature. It sounds like something that DAS does internally at this point. Is that correct?
Representative, are you speaking of what we do for the state as far right now?
Right.
We do a biennial report that I believe goes to the Legislative Audit Committee. And we also have a KPM for whether DAS is effective through a third party. That RFP is in process right now to do that review. It was not done last biennium as a budget reduction selection.
Okay. That answers my question. Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would just encourage for folks, there's been some good discussion about the state motor pool, and I would just encourage, you know, in Ways and Means Sub, last session, Representative Nathanson had hearings on this stuff and went pretty deep into it, and so she's dealt with it in that capacity and also with the task force. I really encourage, you know, those of us with questions, including me, to follow up with her because she's been delving pretty deep in this stuff.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions, appreciate you taking the time and presenting this to us today. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2854 and open a work session on House Bill 2854.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Whitman.
I move House Bill 2854 as a committee to pass it and with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2854 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The fiscal impact was indeterminate.
And you don't have it in your folders.
But we do have a copy of it.
Chair Holby, I just checked with the fiscal office, ran down there during the hearing, and I don't have the paper. If you want to see it, then we should hold up on it, but it is an indeterminate, and it is going to Ways and Means after this.
All right. We're okay. Good. We could hold up on it until the end of the hearing, if you wish. It may be coming to us. I don't know. Did they say they would have it soon?
They didn't say they would deliver it.
It's going to Ways and Means. I'm fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll get there.
With that, Representative Wisnett has made the motion. Could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye. House Bill 2854, having received the required votes, is moved on to Ways and Means.
Representative Nathanson carry.
We don't assign a carrier at this point. It goes to Ways and Means to
thank you, Ms.
for that duty.
Clarify the motion then, because the motion you made, I heard the motion.
Yeah.
So
The motion was to essentially move it to Ways and Means. The motion was to move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Should I clarify my motion?
Okay. I believe that is the correct motion.
Yeah, thank you.
It's just a process that it moves closer to the floor. We're sending it to the direction of the floor with that subsequent referral. So it has to go to Ways and Means first.
I read my script right.
So, with that, the roll call, please. We already did that.
Yeah.
So, now you got me mixed up. So,
sorry, Mr. Chair.
So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2854 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2067.
Would you like me to read?
Yeah. Jane, would you give us a little review of the bill, please?
The bill, House Bill 2067, provides that information collected in an investigation by the Board of Accountancy is confidential unless a notice is issued for a contested case hearing or the matter is finally resolved by the Board action or consent order. Permits the Board to disclose that an investigation is being conducted, and it requires the Board to notify the person being investigated.
Thank you, and good morning. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Professor Raymond Johnson. I'm a CPA. I teach at Portland State University, and I'm chair of the Oregon Board of Accountancy.
Good morning, co-chairs. My name is Pat Hearn. I'm executive director of the Oregon Board of Accountancy.
Great. If you'd deliver your testimony, please.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 2067 would provide for limited confidentiality of related documents and information while the investigation of a complaint filed with the Oregon Board of Accountancy is pending. The information would become disclosable after the matter is dismissed, settled, or notice of a contested case hearing is issued. However, the person being investigated would be provided with copies of the complaint and all related documents in the possession of the board. And if an inquiry was made, board staff would respond only that an investigation was pending. Many, if not most, Oregon regulatory agencies already operate under a similar provision for confidentiality during the pendency of investigation. All 20 health-related licensing boards, including agencies such as the Oregon Medical Board and the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, have confidentiality provisions. And other non-health-related regulatory agencies, such as the Landscape Architect Board and the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, have confidentiality provisions. Now, the board is very sensitive and respective of its role in consumer protection, and it feels that the public and licensees will both benefit from the enactment of the provisions of this bill. Filing of complaints for retaliatory purposes should be discouraged as a result of this bill. And then relevant confidential information related to collateral litigation would be obtainable by the board. And by that, I'm referring that we often have cases that, along with the potential violation being investigated by the board, also involve civil litigation, oftentimes in the federal courts. Attorneys are reluctant to provide us with information that is necessary for the conduct of our investigation because of the fact that they do know that information in our possession is publicly disclosable, and they're concerned that it could jeopardize the outcome of their litigation. And cases such as that often take up to 3 years to resolve in the court. So we have a complaint pending, but we're unable to proceed with it for some substantial period of time until that collateral litigation is resolved. And it really is not beneficial to the public, and it's not beneficial to the licensee to have it drag on that long. So we believe that public protection would be enhanced by a speedier resolution of our complaint. This measure has the full support of our constituency, which is the practicing CPAs in Oregon, that is the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants, and the bill has no negligible fiscal impact on licensees or the Board of Accountancy. Be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Do you have any testimony you'd like to provide?
Yes.
And if you could just restate your name,
okay,
so people are sure clear about that.
My name is Raymond Johnson.
Thank you.
I'm chair of the Oregon Board of Accountancy. Representative Holvey, Representative Witness, other members of the committee. The board, in deliberating this, really felt that this continues to protect the public interest, that there's substantial information about a licensee that would be made available at the time that an item is resolved by the board. Over the last year, we've had at least one or two cases that we feel have been substantially slowed down because trying to get information that people wanted to be confidential, trying to get that into the investigation process. We think the public would actually be protected. I can think of at least several instances where I think we would have been able to speed up our investigation process, reach resolution on a faster basis. And I think for that reason, this protects the public. So I think this continues to protect the public and perhaps would speed up our processes compared to what the way they've worked in the past. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I think it's important that the committee members pick up on your note that 20 other boards have this provision. Is that correct, sir?
Okay. Co-chairs, that's 20 health-related licensing okay. boards. There are several others that aren't health-related that also have it.
And co-chairs, we've looked at their legislation and crafting this legislation to try and learn from best practices.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. When we met, a question I had asked, and you thought you may be able to get an answer by the time we had the hearing, was the examples of, you know, comparing that list of examples of folks who have the provision similar to the one you're requesting to those that don't. And do we get a list of those that don't? Do we know that, and so we can kind of compare a little bit?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, I wasn't able to get a list, but that evening when I returned to the office, I was able to speak with an assistant attorney general who works in the business services division, and they represent all the regulatory agencies. And the only one she could think of is the Racing Commission that does not have a confidentiality provision.
Let's keep it that way. But I'm cool.
And thank you. I think this bill does make sense, and I do want to note that you know, this bill also potentially protects the CPAs from being maligned in the press on a false pretense, perhaps. And I think there's value in that as well, as we're trying to protect jobs and small businesses. CPAs certainly represent both of those types of employment activities. So I appreciate that effort as well. Any other questions? Not seeing any at this point. I appreciate
Thank you.
Your testimony. Thank you very much. And we do have one more testifier signed up, Mr. Douglas. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, here today representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. Joan Buck and myself have had the pleasure of representing CPAs in Oregon for over three decades. Mr. Hearn was correct in his testimony. We do support this legislation. As the co-chairs know, we have not always supported legislation from the regulator, but I want to make sure the committee understands that the State Society does, in fact, support this Board of Accountancy bill.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate that. It'll be nice to be able to have both of you on the same page, as I don't think that was always the case last session.
This is a kumbaya session.
So, any questions from the committee, Mr. Douglas? Doesn't appear to be any. I think the board covered the bill very well. Appreciate you coming forward to let us know your position. Thank you very much. With that, seeing no other interest in discussing the bill any further, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2067. And Mr. Co-Chair,
Mr. Chair,
I will open a work session on House Bill 2067.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2067 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2067 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Can we please have a roll call vote?
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Yes.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2067, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. And do we have a volunteer to carry this on the floor? Representative Sheehan, have you carried a bill yet? Have you been assigned one?
I've been assigned one, yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
I can carry the bill.
Thank you. Aye. Representative Matthews will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2067. Any other business? Representative Wisnett?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'd like to make you aware that in your paperwork today, you received copies of the letters that I had sent to different agencies that testified last week in front of the committee, and I have not received answers to them yet. So as those answers become available, I did this just to save time and would point out to our committee members and my co-chair that now we have 42 hours and we passed five bills. So good. I think that's good work, but we don't have much time to do the rest. So, as I get information back on these, I'll provide them to the committee members. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other business, I will adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.